taken under advisement, the court will proceed to the fifth case, E versus Ashcroft, Mr. Erlokia.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Babasunde Erlokia, and I represent Ememe Feruz, the petitioner in this case. And I'll start with a little background of this asylum application. Ememe Feruz is a woman of Oromo descent in Ethiopia, which is a tribe in Ethiopia. She spent, she left Ethiopia several years ago, spent some years in Italy, never resettled in Italy within the context of immigration laws. She never had the right to leave or work in Italy, and ultimately arrived in the United States in 1999. She has since then married in the United States and has a U.S. citizen child. The testimony in her case would clearly show that she was a member of a particular social group. Her father was accused of supporting the Oromo Liberation Party financially and funneling funds towards that party. Evidence will show, both the background information and her testimony would show that there was a practice then by the Mengistu government and the government that succeeded the Mengistu government of severe repression and oppression of the Oromo tribe. It is not disputed, both in the record and even the country condition reports that is usually prepared by the United States government. She was in school first to learn Amharic, and the language of instruction was Amharic, and she's from the Oromo tribe. Her father was arrested in 1990. She and her brother were ultimately arrested. Up until the time when she had a hearing, her brother's whereabouts were still unknown. At the age of 17, while in detention for 5 months, she was raped twice. On one occasion, she became unconscious. She ultimately became pregnant from the rape incident, and she miscarried this pregnancy while she was in detention. Several months later, her father was beaten to death while he was in detention. Her mom ultimately secured her release, and she left Ethiopia. She went to Italy because it became very clear that she felt her life was unsafe so long as that government or governments of that type remained in power in Ethiopia. By this time, obviously, the nature of the treatment she had received would have put her under some level of psychological stress. On arriving in Italy, her mom was arrested at some point. Her mom died in jail of a heart attack. Her sister, who she met in Italy and who was assisting her with remaining in Italy, ultimately died upon finding out about their mom's death. At her sister's funeral, she believed she saw a man who she believed was one of the rapists when she was in detention. The issues here in this case are whether the immigration judge made his decision based on substantial evidence, whether there were any due process violations, and whether the burden of proof that the immigration judge suggested that the petitioner should have met is consistent with the requirement of the law or case law as it is developed here. And finally, whether his determination of her credibility was based on the evidence and the record. And first, I'll argue that the substantial evidence rule requires that the immigration judge must base his decision on the record and all available evidence, including the background evidence, not necessarily the testimony of the petitioner alone. And in looking at this, clearly, the immigration judge bases his credibility finding on perceived inconsistencies between the petitioner Ms. Feruz's testimony at an earlier sworn statement when she had recently arrived in the United States and what her testimony was at that day in the hearing. Now, you must remember that this sworn statement was taken in Italian language, presumably because Ms. Feruz had just arrived from Italy. This court and all the sister circuits have consistently held that when there is an interpretation problem, there is a major undermining of the constitutional due process rights of the petitioner. The sworn statement in question clearly identified her as Amharic after that she after what language she spoke. She specifically said, I speak Amharic language. And at the hearing before the immigration judge, the issue arose as to, are you Amharic or you just speak Amharic? She said, well, my understanding of the question at that time was, what language do you speak? Matter of fact, it is interesting to note that the ultimate hearing before the immigration judge occurred in Amharic. This already called into question the sworn statement that was taken in Italian language.
Did she indicate at the initial hearing any discomfort in responding in Italian?
No. The questioning in the merits hearing seems to say that, did you ever say you could speak Italian? And her answer to that was basic communication, because she never learned Italian. She lived as a maid for the entire period she was in Italy and didn't speak the language. Now, obviously, after living in a certain environment for a number of years, you can probably minimally communicate in that language. When you're talking about the context of law enforcement, being detained and being asked significant questions under oath, I would think that that calls for definitely a clear understanding of the question and answer format that occurred in that environment. And one of the first questions they asked her was, what was her major language? The sworn statement clearly indicates that she said her major language was Amharic. So I don't understand, you know, there would be no reason for the interview to have been conducted in Italian. Now,
so is it your position that any responses at that initial interview are to be set aside, and so that the IJ only had the testimony at the merits hearing, not at the, he could not look to any of those earlier responses?
Not necessarily the case, Your Honor. But when the final decision of the IJ makes a clear determination of her credibility and the comparisons are her testimony at the hearing against what she said in that sworn statement, that raises a clear question of whether the evidence that the IJ is using to determine this credibility was actually sufficient or, as a matter of fact, factually accurate. Because that was where he based most of his credibility issues. The next issue that arises here is the burden of proof. The IJ says, well, you know, if you've been raped, well, there's no forensic evidence, why did you not try to adduce some forensic evidence of this rape event? I think that that is setting a new standard of proof in this case that has not been recognized in asylum jurisprudence. In any case, as a matter of fact, I don't see how it could have been possible for her to establish by forensic evidence that she was raped when, after the rape occurred, she still remained in detention for several months, had traveled to Italy, remained there for a number of years before arriving in the United States. It is unclear what kind of forensic evidence she would have been able to adduce to establish that she was raped. Now, if the question was there any corroborating evidence that this rape indeed occurred, she was seen and taken in at the Kobler Center for victims of torture. She had several visits there. She spoke with experts. There was a diagnosis of her situation. They spoke extensively about the rape in the expert's report, and they in fact concluded by diagnosing her as having post-traumatic stress disorder.
If we set aside the horror of the rape situation, and what about the birth certificate and specifically the imprisonment of where she said she was not imprisoned? That inconsistency.
Those are good questions, Your Honor. On the imprisonment issue, clearly she already explained that. She said her understanding was, one, was I imprisoned in Italy? And two, my understanding of imprisonment is supposed to be a punishment for a crime. And we've repeatedly had this. The BIA has consistently ruled on this, that there are subjective issues of understanding because of the differences in culture from people who are coming from other parts of the world. Their understanding of imprisonment may be a legitimate law enforcement function, separate and different from the asylum context of imprisonment, of meaning, have you ever been detained for any reason, even though you didn't do anything wrong? And the birth certificate issue, the IJ's conclusion is incorrect. IJ concludes that he's not attacking the validity of the document. His skepticism is based, one, on the fact that, well, how come the immigration officers did not discover this birth certificate during your detention or when you arrived in the United States? There's nothing in the record that supports any search of her person or her property. So there's no reason why the IJ would make an assumption that they could have discovered the birth certificate. The second issue he raises is that the birth certificate should have been authenticated through the American consulate in Ethiopia. There's also no basis for this conclusion. If that were the law, then the vast majority of cases have been decided against the law. It's definitely a practice in the immigration court that a document is presented for the value of the document. If it is in a foreign language, the translation must be, and the translation does not even have to be either before the U.S. consulate or not. So if this was decided specifically because this document was not authenticated by the American consulate in Ethiopia, then it was an abuse of discretion because it was a clear departure from what the normal standard of determining the validity of such documents.
Do you feel, is it your position, I should ask, at the credible fear interview, that where this case went off the track is because she appears to have 7 years of residency, has an Italian passport, and is asked, are you conversant in Italian? And she responds, yes. But you feel that we should set that aside and understand that she really had no meaningful capacity to respond to these inquiries?
Your Honor,
I mean, isn't that what we have? Don't we have to get there to accept your position? And maybe we should. But is that where we've got to go, that really throw out that initial interview with the INS and say that we have somebody who, despite tenure or length of time in Italy and possessed of a passport, that we really shouldn't look to that at all?
Well, Your Honor, I can understand that question, but the context of this credible fear interview is that an asylum officer who's been trained in this practice, who understands the nature of these operations, understands the nature of these occurrences, is taking the credible fear interview. They're also trained to understand that people in that context might have psychological disorders. Probably not, but at least the very least is that they're nervous, they're fearful, and if they're legitimately running away from where they're coming from, their one fear at that time would be, I could be put on a plane and returned. So while the court may not be in that context, whoever was taking this interview at that time had an understanding, and that's why there's several rights that I even read to you at that time, and there's a reading and there's a clear mandate that there must be a clear understanding of what is occurring here. However, if they were reading this to her and asking her, do you understand this, and it was happening in Italian, we're running in circles here, Your Honor.
Well, it's truly difficult. Obviously, the officer is trained to ask what unfortunately are appropriate questions, because he asked whether she's physically assaulted. I mean, at the fear interview. I mean, he is sensitive that she may be coming from an area where she may have been attacked. So he did ask the right questions. You're saying he just did, or she, I don't know.
Yeah, and actually she did answer those questions. The question is that the areas of the credible fear interview that the judge is using for the determination of the credibility are areas that she tried to explain also. The judge says, well, it looks to me like what happened at the sworn statement at the credible fear hearing seems to be that, well, you know, you said that they tried to rape you. She said, and she testified before the judge, I did not say that. I don't understand what happened, but that was not my testimony. And we have the expert's report.
What was the, did you represent her at the merits hearing?
No, Your Honor, I did not represent her at the merits hearing.
Was there any language difficulties at the merits hearing?
No, the merits hearing was held in Amharic, which is the language that she understood very clearly. And that's what even makes it the more interesting on why the Italian interpretation in the initial stage could have been a faulty one, which the judge would have been apparent to the judge right there during that hearing. You know, because I have other issues, I'll reserve them for rebuttal if I get the chance to do that. Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Well, Smith, on behalf of the government. In this case, the immigration judge rejected the petitioner's asylum claim on two alternative bases. First, the immigration judge recently determined that the petitioner was not credible. And second, the immigration judge determined that the petitioner did not otherwise sustain her burden of proof. The immigration judge here reasonably determined that, based on the evidence in the record, that the petitioner did not present credible and persuasive evidence that she was persecuted in Ethiopia, Under the law of this circuit, a credibility finding can only be overturned under extraordinary circumstances. Here, the immigration judge found various inconsistencies between the petitioner's immigration hearing testimony and her prior sworn statement at her credible fear interview.
So, we can... I understand that representation that there's substantial inconsistencies, but
right. This
seems to be presented to us as a case, at least to me, of what we're using to compare, if not our apples and oranges, they're just not susceptible because of this language problem. It's all troubling to Mr. Smith that we end up not in English, not in Italian, but in Amharic at the merits hearing, and we don't have that as a vehicle of understanding at the credible fear interview, which is what's used here. Now, I mean, there's nothing in the law to preclude using the responses in two different languages.
No.
There's some unease connected with that.
Well, I understand. Is it ideal? Obviously not, but I would note that this credible fear hearing was held not at the airport. It was actually held 10 days after her airport arrival, and she was represented at this credible fear hearing. So you have a credible fear hearing, and you have...
And represented by someone Italian, I take it?
By the...
Who represented her? She had a lawyer.
Right.
And I wondered, was the lawyer fluent in her language?
I do not know if he or she
was. Or Italian, because if the lawyer spoke Italian... And she doesn't speak very good Italian, a lawyer wouldn't be a big help. If the lawyer spoke in her language, then that could be helpful if the lawyer understood Italian and understood her language.
But we
don't know the answer to that.
I have no way of knowing if the her previous attorney spoke Italian or Amharic. But at the credible fear interview, she did indicate that she spoke Italian. There is no evidence in the, if you look at the transcript from the interview, that there was a language difficulty. That there was any problem, she answered the questions directly, and she was represented.
She answered the questions as she understood them, whether it was correct answers.
She answered them, right. What I'm saying is...
She responded. I mean, if there was some problem with the meaning of a word within a question, like this whole jail thing or the whole custody thing, if there was some misunderstanding as to what was asked, then... Sure, she could respond, but the response might not be an accurate response.
Right. It's not apparent. What I'm saying is it's not apparent. Maybe it's possible, we just don't know. It's not apparent from the record, which is before the court. There's nothing to show that the transcript that the credible fear interview was unreliable.
Would the transcript reflect extensive responses as opposed to yes, no? The kind of Q&A where you have a significant question and a short answer. Could you characterize them? Of course, we can check it.
They were not very extensive, but they weren't just yes or no. I mean, she did respond. They were maybe a sentence, sometimes yes and maybe no. But you know, they weren't. It was kind of in between. It wasn't as extensive, obviously, as a merits hearing. But these inconsistencies do relate to the heart of her asylum claim and come to specific cogent reasons for the immigration judge to question her credibility. And also, given her lack of credibility, the immigration judge's decision is additionally supported by the fact that she did not present any reliable corroborating evidence to support her claim of past persecution.
Well, on the whole rape question, what kind of evidence do you think would have been adequate so many years after the fact? What kind of evidence could she have provided?
Concerning her alleged past persecution, she could have provided evidence such as death certificates for her family members, corroborative documents such as affidavits, letters from people in Ethiopia, evidence from her employer in Italy, evidence from religious leaders, evidence that there was a funeral in Italy.
What about the rape? I think I asked about that.
About the rape specifically, evidence from, well, she did indicate specifically that in her testimony that her mother had a friend, her father's friend, and that her father's friend or her mother's friend helped her get released from custody in Ethiopia. So there's no indication that he could not otherwise provide any corroborating evidence. It's not uncommon in immigration cases for people who are still living in the country of the alien's nationality to provide corroborated documents, such as affidavits, letters.
What about the diagnosis at the Kogler Center?
At the what?
The diagnosis at the Kogler Center that she was suffering post-traumatic. I don't have the, I didn't pull the term.
It indicates that...
The Kogler
right.
Center, right.
It indicates that she has had some a type of, suffered some type of stress.
Right, post-traumatic.
But it does not compel the conclusion that she was raped or then that she was raped in Ethiopia by the government. I think I would stress that the fact that a person could find a plausible explanation for the inconsistency or for the lack of corroboration does not mean one must be compelled to do so. The standard is evidence must compel one conclusion only. But in this case, the immigration judge reasonably determined, based on the record and what the immigration judge had before him, he found inconsistency. When an immigration judge does not know what to believe, it is entirely reasonable for the immigration judge to require the asylum applicant to provide corroboration. In this case, we just don't have any corroborating evidence to support her claim.
No, there's one thing I just want to interject here that seems that several cases that are coming out this fall all go to the two C's, credibility and corroboration. This is some kind of a standard that's going to be in every case, and we start running into this credibility here with the language barrier. We're not even sure they understand it, and corroboration in situations where it would be rather, in some cases, and I am not saying necessarily this, more it's monumental to get it, to get some additional stuff. And I'm just wondering if we have to say, well, we give deference and all that, but it seems that these cases lately have just been focusing on this and make it more and more difficult to try to find out what's the right answer, other than just saying, well, we defer to the IJ, he judges the credibility, and there's no corroboration, therefore, when you don't know the answer, they lose.
Well, the law states that the alien's testimony in and of itself can be sufficient without corroboration, but it has to be credible, persuasive, and candid.
Yes, so it can be sufficient
standing
alone.
Yes, it can be, but
and
again,
most of the problems with the inconsistencies here were the IJ comparing that initial interview and what she actually said on the stand in the full hearing, right?
That's correct.
Where all the inconsistencies came from. So if that
yes.
first interview is defective,
right.
then the ruling of the IJ...
Not the entire ruling, but...
But that's the bulk of
the
what
credibility,
it, that
right.
certainly, if that was off the table, it wouldn't be much left in terms of his credibility finding.
Then the alternative question would be, the other question is, did she otherwise sustain her burden of proof? But again, there is no indication or evidence in the record that the initial interview, again, where she was represented and she stated that she spoke Italian, that is defective. Now, if there was evidence that was defective, I mean, and there are cases where the interviews have been discounted because there was a bad interpretation or something like that. That's a different story, but that's simply not the case.
Right, but as
here.
You said, we don't know what language her lawyer spoke.
That I do not know. I looked back, but I do not, no, I don't, I cannot, I couldn't tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
But she did indicate that she spoke Italian. She presented herself as an Italian, with an Italian, finally an Italian passport, but as an Italian, and she had lived in Italy for 7 years. Again, that's also important. But here, the immigration judge reasonably determined, based on the inconsistency.
And you don't dispute that when she lived in Italy, she was a maid. So in terms of, so in other words, it wasn't like working in an office where use of the language would, of necessity, you would have to be fluent.
Right.
Working in a shop, so you got to communicate with people. I mean, you could have very minimal communication skills as a maid and get the job done.
It's possible. Again, we don't know exactly. We do not know that much about what her work was. We just know what she said. She said she was a maid. She would speak to her employer. Her sister was also employed there. But we don't really know much else about that. It is somewhat limited, and that's a difficulty with a lot of these cases, but we just have to focus on what we have before us at this time. So unless the court has any other questions, I look to see my time's out.
All right.
Okay.
Your
you.
Time has expired, but you may have 1 minute to respond.
Thanks for this opportunity, Your Honor. Like my colleague rightly said, this case boils down to two things, the burden of proof and the credibility determination. The burden of proof, like I submitted earlier on, was we're requesting a threshold that would have been impossible. For instance, we have the Culver Center's recommendation. We have their report saying that this woman suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder and identifying the rape as one of the reasons why she suffers from that. That is corroboration. What else could she possibly have done? Maybe she carried the baby to full term and could establish that it was the product of a rape. Even that would not have met the burden. The credibility, like he rightly admitted, was based, in the most part, on comparison from her testimony at the marriage hearing with what I term as this discredited, credible interview. Now, there's no suggestion that there were any inconsistencies between her written asylum application and her testimony at the hearing, which in the vast majority of asylum cases is all we usually have, the written application and the testimony at the hearing. And that's why time and time again we hear, was the story internally consistent? So the external inconsistencies there are factors that came from outside of what her internal consistencies were. And that would be my submission, Your Honor.
And I assume, counsel, you don't know what language her lawyer spoke or her representative spoke in Italy.
Your Honor, I do not know what language whoever represented her at the credible fair hearing spoke. But I know that at the marriage hearing, she did clearly say, that wasn't my understanding. And one thing we may even be overlooking here is, not only could she have had a problem with understanding the questions as they were coming to her in Italian language, whoever this interpreter was may have had a problem interpreting whatever her limited understanding, if any, of the Italian language back to the credible fair interviewer. Thank you.
All right, thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.